The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Well, I think at some point he probably will be allowed back on and probably should be allowed back on.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
So, who do you think said that President Trump should be allowed back on social media? Probably somebody you may not expect at all. What's your guess? I'll give you the answer to that coming up in just a moment. Want to welcome you. It's good to be back. I'm Drew Mariani. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for allowing me to be part of your afternoon. It is always good to hang out with you. And boy, a lot's going on, isn't it? I was saying to my wife this morning as I was finishing a second cup of coffee and getting ready to head out the door to come to the network, I was like, man, where has the time gone? Right? Did you feel the same way? I mean, 2020 was a year of lockdown. 2021, for me at least, has been a blur. Feast of St. Joseph just passed. You know, we had that solemnity during this great year, and we are now knocking on the door of Holy Week, and then it'll be Easter and the Feast of Mercy, and before you know it, May and June and July 4th will be here. We're more than halfway through the year. Now, I know, you're saying, stop it. Don't wish the year away. You're right. Let's live in the present moment. Let's enjoy where we are right now. Take today for what it is. That's my advice to you. You know, don't take it for granted. You don't know, you don't know whether you have another one. I also think back. I saw somebody with some kids the other day, my wife and I had five, really, we had our kids all in about 6 years. We had five kids in about 6 years. So you can only imagine how busy the Mariani household was, right? And I saw this parent with their young kids, and my advice to any young parent is enjoy those kids at whatever stage they are, because you blink their eyes, next thing you know, they're in school. Then you blink their eyes, they're driving, and then you never see them again. They've got jobs, they got friends, and then they're off to college, and time just flies. Live in the present moment. We always live for the future, don't we? Oh, I can't wait till I can retire. I can't wait till I can do this. Oh, I can't wait till I can do that. We're always looking down the road for that vacation, you know, this next big thing that's going to happen. Enjoy today. Do you have health today? Enjoy it, because it may not be there tomorrow. You know, do you have your children? Enjoy them. They're going to be gone one day. Do you have a job? Thank God for it. And live in the present moment. I think it's such an important thing. We don't know what tomorrow holds. Don't worry about tomorrow. Scripture tells us it'll take care of itself. Just my advice to you. You know, because I looked at the calendar and it's March Madness already, which means, I don't know if you're into March Madness or not. It's an annual ritual where people, they try to guess which basketball teams are going to make it through all the way to the playoffs and into the final game to determine the national championship. And here's the thing, with COVID and people getting sick, it's like throwing a dart at a wall. I mean, who knows? Of course, you can't have something like that without gambling going on. People love to bet on sports. They do. Oh, yeah. You know, you probably are playing a bracket in the office or at home or with friends. Until about a couple years ago, that was illegal. And most of it was done off the books. You'd call a bookie or you just do it, you know, in a small office pool or something like that. But now it's been legalized in 20 states and Washington, D.C. So betting on the event with the most games in it is just gone off the charts. And people love betting on basketball. I thought football would be bigger than basketball, but apparently they're saying about $1 billion is going to be spent on basketball. My phone operator today, Patrick Alog, one of the great contributors on this show here, he tried to bet on DraftKings. He can't because he lives in the state of Wisconsin where that is illegal. Wow, very interesting, Patrick. All right. But March Madness is back on. So I don't know. Do you bet on sports, you know, the March Madness tournament? Places like Atlantic City, New Jersey, they're rejoicing. Why? Well, their restaurants, casinos, bars have reopened. They're receiving crowds of sports fans. In fact, ABC6 was on the scene. They covered the story. Check this out.
March Madness is back on.
Well, we're here because it didn't happen last season.
Basketball fans here at Ocean Casino Resort say after last year's tournament was canceled, this year they're going all out.
We actually had reservation to come down here last year, And we were coming up until 2 days before they canceled the tournament. I was at work. I got the terrible news.
Now they're here in person, many placing bets at the sports book. They say it's a little more exciting than betting online.
I just bet like through the apps and stuff at home, but this is my first time at the sports book in Atlantic City, and we're really excited to be down here and watch all the games.
The pandemic shut down New Jersey's casinos for 107 days, and online gaming took over. According to data analysis done by Stockton University, New Jersey's online revenue during the pandemic almost doubled compared to the 12 months before the pandemic started. But in-person gaming took a big hit, and total revenues for New Jersey casinos dropped by 20% compared to the year before. Operators say bringing people back in person is critical.
We're just happy to have people back in the building. This is the biggest event that we've done on property since we reopened last summer.
Yeah, I actually was watching CBS Sunday morning, and they did a piece on March Madness and gambling and how people are itching to get it back. In fact, I saw a piece in Market Watch, and analysts there are expecting anywhere between, check this number out, $1 and $1.5 billion worth of legal bets to take place with those brackets. If you've wagered, good luck to you. I hope you do well. You almost have to wonder how much of that's going to be funded by the government checks a lot of people are receiving. Hey, a little extra cash. Let me see if I can make this go further, right? You know, from a Catholic perspective, you know, just a reminder. And if you don't have this book, I really want to strongly recommend it to you. Get a Catechism of the Catholic Church, okay? It goes right next to the Bible. That's where it sits on my bookshelf. You know, and read it. Here's what the church teaches. It says, games of chance and wager are not in themselves contrary to justice. They become morally unacceptable when they deprive somebody of what's necessary to provide for his needs and those of others. The passion for gambling risks become more of an enslavement, it says. So if you have a problem with gambling, get some help with it. You know, great group out there, Gamblers Anonymous. But you want to put a couple bucks down, have some fun, it's entertainment? Sure. The church doesn't have a problem with that. You know, when you can't put diapers on your kids, right? You can't feed them. You're not paying your bills because you're trying to wager. That's when it becomes morally problematic. So, hey, on another note, Donald Trump, guess what? Did you hear what he's doing now? Yeah, I mean, isn't it crazy how the media is still talking about him? I mean, they will not let him go. The former president is coming back to social media. And guess where it's going to be? It's not going to be on Twitter. It's not going to be on Facebook. It's not going to be on Instagram. It's not going to be on any of the other big companies who kicked him off their platforms, mostly on charges that he incited the violence that led to the takeover of the Capitol on January 6th by that mob. It's not even going to be an alternative like Parler or MeWe or Telegram. Check this out. Here's what the president said. I don't know whether you're going to follow him or not. Maybe he had his day in the sun. Maybe you said, hey, I'd love to hear what he's saying. He apparently is coming out with his own social media platform. And at least one advisor told Fox it's going to completely redefine the game. I mean, you got to realize he had, what, 88 million followers on Twitter? He understood the power of it. It only made sense. So he's going to say, hey, I'm coming out. I'm going to redefine the game. Nobody knows exactly what that means. I don't. But if it's as big as what he claims, although the president tends to inflate things a little bit, it could could possibly upend the way that Silicon Valley has dominated the social media structure for the last few years. And we apparently know in 2 or 3 months what he's going to do, because that's what's going to happen. So the exciting news was announced by Jason Miller. He's the former advisor to Trump. And here's what he told Fox News.
I do think that we're going to see President Trump returning to social media in probably about 2 or 3 months here with his own platform. And this is something that I think will be the hottest ticket in social media. It's going to completely redefine the game. And everybody is going to be waiting and watching to see what exactly President Trump does. But it will be his own platform. There have been a lot of high-powered meetings he's been having at Mar-a-Lago with some teams of folks who've been coming in. And I got to tell you, there have been, it's not just one company that's approached the president. There have been numerous companies. But I think the president does know what direction that he wants to head here. And this new platform is going to be big, and everyone wants him. He's going to bring millions and millions, tens of millions of people to this new platform.
I'm curious to see what's being pitched and who will follow and what influence we'll have. Don't forget, that's a powerful platform when it comes to the election cycles, you know. The president was muted, banned, and kicked out. It'd be cool to have some video content on that, my producer Jake was telling me. The person you heard a few moments ago, he was telling CNBC Squawk Box that He believes that President Trump should be allowed back on social media. And I know that's a contentious point. A lot of people argue, no, he was responsible for the riot. He was responsible for the insurrection. Other people saying, come on, that's ridiculous. One person who said, you know, he should be back on is somebody who you may not expect. It was Bill Gates. Yes, Bill Gates said Donald Trump should be allowed back on. Listen to his comments. And then, of course, you can always let me know how you feel.
Well, I think at some point he probably will be allowed back on and probably should be allowed back on. But I'll bet they'll find a way to let him back on. You know, his stuff may be labeled as false in a lot of cases. You know, in a way, his people's interest in what he says may go down quite a bit. That'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, that's really true. Will 88 million people follow him? I don't know. Possibly, possibly not. Or will he get tens of millions of people? As we said, you know, it might be smart if Twitter and all these other groups let him on. Otherwise, he's going to be their direct competition, which I think is the case. I don't think he'd go back there anyway. Maybe he would. Who knows? Anyway, coming up a little bit later, too, I want to share with you a story. I don't have time right now to share it with you, but I want to talk to you about an unbelievable discovery archaeologists made in our own country. They made this in Maryland, in the state of Maryland. And I love American history. I'll tell you what they found coming up in a few moments. But before I do that, I do want to bring your attention to some international affairs. And I often say to you, you know, so often in America, we get a very local view, don't we? We only hear about what's happening in the U.S. If you ever travel abroad and you watch Sky News or some of the other outlets, BBC, you really get a global look of what's happening in the world. I read a piece this morning. I've been following what's been happening in the country of Belarus. It's a country that not too many Americans pay attention to. It borders Russia. In fact, if I would guess, only a very small percentage of the country could probably even locate it on a map. It's actually on the northwest border of Russia. It's between Poland, Ukraine, and Latvia. But this small country, I'm going to ask for your prayers for these people because what they're going through is unbelievable. They're undergoing upheaval right now, really of the worst kind. Last year, Alexander Lukashenko, who was the dictator of that country, declared himself the winner of an election, even though it was clearly a rigged and fraudulent election. And in response, people began protesting, and as a result, the government began to crack down. And the crackdown has been horrible. I saw a video of this crackdown and the way people are being treated and the things they're doing. In fact, I don't even want to describe it to you. But imagine this. Just imagine having to escape, flee from this type of place. CNN has footage of one person who shared their harrowing journey away from the oppression that those people are experiencing. Listen.
Across the border and out of what's been called Europe's last dictatorship, Belarus. Some walk if they can. One man, we'll call him Sergei, had no choice but to swim it. Nearly 3 miles. Here he stands, on sheet ice, free, but in anguish at having to flee, after just crossing out of Belarus into the safety of Ukraine. He films himself in flippers and a wetsuit to leave evidence of what he tried in case he doesn't make it. I'll try to crawl there, he says, and hope I won't freeze. I'm navigating by the stars. The feeling is indescribable. I've been going 90 minutes and have a mile left. Beaten and detained before for protesting and on a wanted list, he had to flee imminent arrest. Can't turn back now.
It's testament to how bad things have got in Belarus that people feel compelled to make this dark, perilous journey, a run to freedom the likes of which Europe hasn't really seen since the Soviet Union.
Belarus, caught between Russia and the European Union, has been ruled for decades by autocratic President Alexander Lukashenko. He declared victory in August elections the US said were fraudulent. Huge protests followed, and he moved swiftly to crush them. He and Russian President Vladimir Putin are two peas in a pod when it comes to shutting down dissent. So Putin swiftly helped his skiing partner with $1.5 billion, another unspecified aid. Months of systematic repression and torture followed, documented by human rights groups. CNN has obtained from defected police officers videos exposing abuse leaked from the police's own archives. Here, the white SUV is full of activists fleeing a protest crackdown. Riot police pounce, one fires a gun.
They fired a live round actually into that vehicle. People got out of the car, and what they did to these people was absolutely atrocious. There are some police who have left the department. They're actually releasing this video, and CNN did a report on the crackdown and the brutality that I saw. And I was reading this morning. I thought, I've got to share this with you. The systematic repression of people who want the government to acknowledge their will. I mean, you're talking about people who have been beaten and tortured in the worst kind of way, rape with police battalions, more. I don't want to go into the details of it. It's horrific. And, of course, this is worrying for Moscow because Belarus has been supportive of you know, Russian President Vladimir Putin, who sent, as you heard in that piece, a huge loan to Lukashenko. And now Russia's a little bit worried about, you know, what this means for them. Will the people be disenchanted with Russia? And it's spilling over into Russia because, you know, of course, Putin, you know, had poisoned a dissenter recently and imprisoned him once he voluntarily returned to Russia. So here, to just put this on your radar, make sure you know what's going on, is Glenn Howard. He's the president of the Jamestown Foundation, one of the world's leading research and analysis organizations on Eurasia. You can check him out at jamestown.org. And it is good to have you with me today, Glenn. Thank you for your time.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
This is disturbing. And, you know, I know a lot of Americans don't always get a lot of international news. They might get a little smidgen here or there. But when you see the suffering and the oppression that's taking place in Belarus, I just wanted to bring it to the country. Give us a perspective, maybe, you know, the large view, if you could. How long have these protests been going on? How long has Lukashenko been in power? And how's he maintained that power?
Well, Belarus is a very strategic country. It borders NATO Poland and also the Baltic states, and there's a strategic corridor to the Baltic called the Suwalki Corridor, which Belarus sits astride, and it's like a bone in the throat of NATO if there were Russian troops based and operating there. Now, Lukashenko's been in power for over 20 years. The best way you can liken the situation is to that of Tito and Stalin. Wow. If you want to make the analogy current analogy to Lukashenko and his relations with Russia. The Russians have been wanting to put air bases inside of Belarus. They are allies,
right,
in the same way that there were allies between Tito and Stalin. But it's a situation where he has been in power, and he's going to keep staying in power in the same way that many of the regimes in Eastern Europe, you know, were tended to be staying in power for quite a bit of time. But there's only one number one, as there was with Tito. So Lukashenko is someone that is a bit of an enigma to people in the West. I mean, this is a country where it's very Soviet in some ways, but it was created in 1991 after the split of the breakup of the Soviet Union, and right, so it doesn't have a very long history of statehood. It was briefly independent in the 1920s. Yes, what is happening there now is very bad, and there are certainly, in the history of the country, it's pivoted between East and West, and what has happened now, and this isn't the first rigged election. The difference now is that the election previously was at 55% as opposed to 90% or
85%.
Right, right. So there isn't but a big proportion of its population lives in Poland because they work there as guest workers. And so it's geopolitically kind of wedged between these areas, and it's also Putin and Lukashenko get along quite well, but it's always understood in the relationship that there's no substitute for him in this relationship. And the Russians have just announced they tried to create a new political movement and party there. And the geopolitical importance used to be nothing to the West until the invasion of Crimea.
Right.
Then, after Crimea began in 2014, it's become kind of a geopolitical battleground, and in the sense that the Russians have been trying to punish Lukashenko because they wanted to establish air bases there, and then he said no. And now Lukashenko in turn turned to China and started getting assistance from China, economic and military support. So its relationship with Russia is not one-dimensional.
Right,
it doesn't just, you know, it's a country that depends on relations and economic ties. Right. with Moscow, but it also has a big chunk, half of its trade goes is with Europe and the European Union. But it's a very authoritarian regime. Don't get me wrong.
No, I get you. No, I totally.
But it's not a situation. Yes, what's happening here is very bad. Is what's happening in Burma and Myanmar bad? Yes. Yeah. Is it really, really bad? Yes. They've killed 40, 50 people. Demonstrators have been shot and killed.
Yeah, I know.
Lukashenko has killed people, right? I don't disagree with that. But it's also. Go ahead.
So where are the people on this? I mean, the video that you see has tens of thousands of people streaming into the streets.
Yeah, warm weather. When the weather's good, okay, these people were out. And it completely unprecedented. It's a big chunk of the young population. But what happened was winter rolled in, snow, and opposition began to kind of suspend its operations. A big part of it went to Lithuania, which there's a very strong rivalry between Lithuania and Belarus.
Sure.
And you have NATO member states very outraged over this. But the dilemma for the West is how much do you push them into the arms of Russia? Now, one group in the West will say he's already buddies with Putin. The other group says, well, there's something called national sovereignty. And there's there's an element of that he doesn't want to let Russian cronies come in and rule the country. That's why there's no Russian oligarch. There's no oligarchs in the country. It's only him. It's number one. And he doesn't envision a situation where he's number two. Now, this has complicated U.S. problems because it's a pendulum for him where he goes back and forth between East and West. They previously had a visa-free travel regime for 80 different countries of the world where you could show up in Belarus and travel there. It was listed on one of Europe's top tourism destinations prior to what happened in last August. It's a very cheap place to go to. They were opening up to the West, but it's always understood that there's number one. There is an authoritarian figure there. There's no doubt. But did he try to have good relations with the West and the United States? Yes, even to the point that John Bolton went there.
Wow.
And John Bolton went to Belarus to meet, and then they made him a deal to start providing them oil so that they could lessen their dependence on Russia. So everything you said is correct. It's a very authoritarian regime, but it's also, I just want to add a political fault line because the irony here, the real irony is, yes, they're cracking down, but 40% of Ukraine's oil comes from Belarus, and that oil goes into the Ukrainian army that is fighting the Russians. So it's a very complicated country.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Well, it is a very complicated country.
Glenn, I'd love to talk to you more. I've got to take a break here. I'd love to have you back. We're going to continue to monitor, but thank you for your time and for your perspective. That's Glenn Howard, president of the Jamestown Foundation, one of the world's leading research and analysis organizations on Eurasia. They're based in Washington, D.C., and their website, jamestown.org. Stay with me. I'll be back with more right after this.
Do you like to hear bells at Mass? Hi, this is Father Rocky with our 29th lesson on the Mass. I love bells, don't you? Bells are permitted at Mass, but they're not mandatory. Still, I think they add something beautiful to the experience. When I was chaplain at Northridge Prep School for Boys, the 6th and 7th graders always wanted to serve and always wanted something active to do, like ringing the bells. If it were up to them, they'd ring the bells all Mass long. But no, only three times. Once at the epiclesis, when the priest puts his hands over the gifts and invokes the blessing of the Holy Spirit. Again, for the second time, when the priest elevates and shows the host to the people. And third time is when the priest elevates the chalice and shows the blood of Christ to the people. The bells at Mass tell us that a miracle has just happened, the transubstantiation. You've been joining me for Lenten Lessons on the Mass. Now I'd like to invite you to join me for Mass itself at noon Central.
And join us for Class After Mass. It's The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Drew Mariani is here for you on Relevant Radio.
Well, it's good to be back with you. Pray the Chapel coming up in about a half an hour. Tell your friends, your loved ones, if you have a special need. I would love to be able to pray with you, that's for sure. So we'll do that coming up soon. I want to get you plugged into a new book. Yeah, it's not my book, although I hope you'll sign up for that book. There's a, you know, I just wrote a book called Divine Mercy, and you get it for free if you just go to relevantradio.com. And if you love the chaplet or you love Divine Mercy, that is that's the place to go. All right. And so we said limited quantities because we're giving it away free. We're even paying for the shipping and handling to get it to you. That's here. But I came across another book, and it's Lent. And I want to plug this. It's from a retired archbishop from the city of brotherly love. Charles Chaput, you know him, right? Very eloquent, wonderful leader. He wrote a new book called Things Worth Dying For, Thoughts on a Life Worth Living. And I thought, you know, this is such a, during Lent, I think it's so important to be able to read things that can really draw you closer to God. You know, and you know, of course, being Lent, and one of the readings you hear a lot during the season is where the Lord, you know, he tells us to take up our cross and follow him. Now, a lot of us, you know, we take that as meaning that we need to take up our daily burdens, our pains, our sufferings, right? All those different sacrifices that come our way. And that certainly has a sound foundation. I think you could be right interpreting that way. But if you said take up your cross to a Christian in the first century, that meant certain death. There was no mere symbolism involved in that at all. It had a different connotation than perhaps those of us in the 21st century, how we view it. One of the things that Lent, I think, can be good for is distilling what's really important in our spiritual life. Because, look, it's supposed to be a desert experience. I don't know how your Lent's going. I hope it's going well. I hope you're suffering well. I hope you are, you know, embracing those three pillars of you know, prayer and fasting and almsgiving. I hope you're doing penance. I've always said this because I'm guilty of it myself. I'll take the giant plank out of my own eye first, right? We, as Americans, we are way too comfortable, you know? Being out in the desert isn't something that most of us really understand or enjoy, right? And we kind of avoid it. I know that's how I am. I'm too soft. As much as I try, I've tried to rekindle my love of fasting and engage in more penitential acts. But when you're out there alone, when you're in the desert, you know, when you are connecting with God, I think you begin to see what's really important and what's not. And really, life is so short. I think it's important that we reflect on what's worth dying for. That's what Jesus called us to when he made that statement. And I think you need to consider whether or not it's worth dying for him. And for other things of value, things like your family or friends or honor or virtue. We live in a culture where vice is celebrated, championed, advanced, taught. Virtue can be in short supply. I think we need to die for that, stand up for the truth. And with the way our society is headed right now, I think we need people who can put those particular things at the top of the list and say, yes, I'm willing to die for these. I'm joined this afternoon by a friend, Mayor. He's a senior fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a senior research associate at the University of Notre Dame. And he previously served with the great Archbishop as his special assistant and is a very good friend of his. He told me off air right before coming on, he says, this is a great book. He says, I think it's one of his best. So get it. So if you want it, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, ask your religious bookstores, see if you can pick it up. Fran, thank you for your time today. Good to have you back.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Drew. Thanks for having me.
You know, I was reflecting on this book, I don't think too many people really consider what's worth dying for on a daily basis, never mind once a year. And this time of year is really when that focus, I think, comes into much clearer focus, if you will. Why was that the question at the top of the Archbishop's mind? What did he intend for the book, and how do you read it?
Well, I think a part of it is, of course, that the Archbishop retired just about a month after he started working on this. So he was 75 when he began, Drew, and he's looking back on a life that's been incredibly productive and trying to figure out how does he communicate to people the importance of dedicating yourself to something in terms of producing long-term happiness. So the title is, you know, the lead title is Things Worth Dying For. The subtitle, though, is really what's important here, Thoughts on a Life Worth Living. Right. It's a book about the things that are worth living for. And you find that out by asking yourself honestly, is there anything in my life that I'd be worth dying for? Mm-hmm. If the answer is no, then there's something profoundly missing in your life. And I think what people will find in this book is really, number one, a beautiful and very moving personal testimony on the part of the Archbishop, some excellent cultural analysis, but really pointing people to the fundamental questions that they need to be asking themselves on a regular basis.
Yeah. Yeah. Facing up to this question that he poses, and I'm delighted he did it. I mean, if you're really honest with yourself, it's hard. It really is. I mean, would we really truly stand up for our faith if push came to shove in the culture today? Where are we when it comes to virtue? You know, do we want to be politically correct, not offend somebody? Are we willing to capitulate, you know, on some of these issues? But then I go back and I think, well, it's kind of a tough question, but is it something that we're trained for today? You know, I come from a generation that perhaps did not have that great of a formation. And look, I know you're very well formed. Your take on that, where are we today? I take a look at not just my generation, but my kids' generation now. You see so many exiting the faith, and I think it's because they don't understand the beauty of what is contained within it. What are your thoughts on that? Do we have the proper formation to be able to do what the bishop is challenging us to do?
No, that's the short answer, but it's easily gotten by just simply reorienting your life and taking the time to, you know, read the Word of God and make an effort, even a small effort, to pursue God and to allow Him into your life. I mean, the book, what interests me most about the book is his emphasis on memory, Drew. I mean, he begins and he ends talking about memory, and not memory as nostalgia, but memory as a way of purifying and maintaining our identity. At the beginning of the book, if you've had an opportunity to look at it, is a reflection on Israel. And, of course, the first chapter, I think, is, you know, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, and it comes from Psalm, I think, 137, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. The genius of the Jewish people, one of the genius elements of the Jewish people, is their relentless commitment to remembering who they are, the covenant they have with God, and their chosenness. And that's what we should be doing. I mean, that's why they've survived, and the church survives remembering and learning from her past and then applying it to the new challenges that face her in the future. So each one of us as a believer has the obligation to remember why we're here, to remember who we are. And everything about the modern world, and particularly the United States, I think, because of its spurning of the past, yeah. I mean, is you know, leading us to forget that and being kind of cocooned in a permanent present with an orientation toward the future, but never to the past. That's very, very dangerous for the survival of a people or a culture or a church.
Yeah. You said this is his best work. Why do you say that? He's written some great stuff.
Yeah, you know, this book is more revealing of him. He was very careful. I worked for him for 23 years, and I now, you know, it's been a year since the two of us retired and we stayed in daily touch. But, I mean, I think he always was very careful not to advance himself personally and always focus on the church, always focus on others. This book mixes a lot of deep thought and some, you know, some important cultural analysis with personal side, the personal side of his life that he didn't reveal very often, you know, in his early life in Kansas and things like that. There's not a great deal of it, but there's enough to really give you a portrait of the man and round him out as a personality and a thinker and a presence in the church. The other thing, too, which I think was really clever, was his chapter on the church. Half of that chapter is handed over to lay people, religious, and priests. Wow. To have them talk about what the church means to them.
Wow.
And in the context of his own, he answers the same questions himself in that chapter. But I mean, it's an extremely interesting chapter because the names are all anonymous. I mean, there's nobody identified by name, but there's real candor and some beautiful stories in that chapter that are just amazing. You know, about a woman who, one of the women that was interviewed is a businesswoman, a longtime friend of his, who had left the church, was brought back to the church when her son was murdered.
Wow.
And the priest who counseled her was just extraordinary. And then later, Drew, this is even more incredible. Later, her father, the same woman's father, who had been away from the church for 40 years, she got him to go to confession before this routine surgery.
Wow.
It wasn't routine. He died.
Wow.
I mean, and the just the power of reading people's kind of really authentic interior answer to these questions about what the church means to them is, and then, you know, the Archbishop saying that, answering the same question, is really powerful, I thought.
Well, it is a great read for Lent, that's for sure. And my producer, Patrick, just told me he put the link up on our Twitter page so people can go ahead and get it. Fran, I only have a few minutes before I've got to take a quick break here. Your final thoughts on the book, where we are now, and anything you want to leave us with?
I think the book is finally amazingly and beautifully positive. I mean, the ending, and I don't want anybody to read the end of the book first because that's just a killer. But the end of the book is one of the most powerful endings I've ever read. And it's incredibly beautiful. I mean, just really incredibly beautiful, really memorable.
That's awesome. Well, hey, thank you for being here. And have a great Lent if we don't talk again, and a blessed Easter.
And you too, Drew.
Always good to have you. I just wanted to put that on everyone's radar here. That's Fran Mayer, of course, a good friend of the Archbishop. And the book, Things Worth Dying For, Thoughts on a Life Worth Living. And Patrick put a link up on our Twitter page, so you can find more about that there as well. Hey, I have to take a short pause. When I come back, speaking of, well, the afterlife, if you will, what happens at the moment we die, I want to share with you an encounter I had with a priest who died. His neck got snapped in a brutal car accident, and he shared his own experience. It puts into perspective why living a life of virtue is so important. I'll share that with you, and if I have time, I'll get you plugged into that discovery by archaeologists here in our own country in Maryland. It's an amazing one. Stay with me. That and more straight ahead. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, coming up in about 14 minutes, we'll pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Can't wait to do that. That's the highlight of my day with you. And a giant thank you to everyone who's already gotten my book. Look, I grappled when it came to writing a book as to whether or not to charge, right? Just do it independently and send it off to a publisher make sure that, it got marketed and promoted, and we sold the book like most authors do. And Relevant Radio said, hey, let's write a book, Drew, but let's give it away. They really, Father Rocky's got this philosophy that, the things of God should be free. You know, and when it came to Divine Mercy, I mean, writing a book of my personal experience or other thing is one thing, but when it comes to passing on what Jesus Christ himself gave to St. Faustina, right? This revelation that he wants the entire world to know. How do you put a price on that, huh? During pledge drives, I often ask you to support, right? And I often bring up a point that I truly believe in, and this is where I'm walking the walk and practicing really what I preach. I believe we build our eternal treasure. I think the sacrifices, the good works, the love, the charity that we do on this side of the veil, it carries for all eternity. And that's why during the pledge drive, I ask you, hey, help evangelize, help with this mission. And I know you do. You come through in this hour unbelievably. I'm always so humbled by your generosity. So I thought the same thing with Relevant. Relevant says, look, we'll pay for the shipping and handling. We'll pay for the printing. We're going to pay for the binding. We're going to pay for this, everything that goes into this. Let's just get the message of Divine Mercy into the hands of people. And I could not be more elated. I could not be happier. I could not be more delighted at this thought. Yeah, my eternal treasure, it awaits me in heaven. When I draw my final breath, I pray to God I see him. I hope I'm met by the merciful Savior and Our Lady and St. Faustina and Blessed Sapochko and Father Seraph and all these great Divine Mercy advocates. I hope I stand in their company as having introduced God's unfathomable mercy to others. You know, the angels say that, well, St. Faustina says, really, she recorded this in her diary. She says, it's the wonder of the saints and the astonishment of the angels. That's what Divine Mercy is. All throughout eternity, we will contemplate the mystery of God's mercy. Never be able to comprehend or fathom it. So I wrote this book, and I want to give it away to you free. But here's the thing, and I didn't mention this the first week, but there are limited quantities. I got to be direct and be honest and straight with you. There are only so many books that we have that we're going to run. And if you want to get on board, it's not too late. This is probably going to be one of the last weeks I'm going to talk about this for a while, at least during Holy Week. And you know, we got other things really to focus on. But I want to put it on your radar if it's new. And this is a great book. It'll transform your life, I'm telling you. It'll help you to trust in difficult times. It'll give you the spiritual armor you need for protection. It will help you to understand the devotion. It'll give you the formulas you need for Divine Mercy Sunday. It's loaded with prayers. Some of my favorite Divine Mercy prayers I included in the back of the book. I've included a Divine Mercy image that you can have. And I say this with humility. Please, I hope you don't misinterpret me. I've read a lot of Divine Mercy books, and there's some brilliant works out there. I think this is up there, not in terms of his brilliance, but in terms of what it offers. You know, it's a great introduction to Divine Mercy. I'm really proud of this book. I'm really, really proud of it. Here's how you get it. And go now, okay? Don't wait. I want you to go right now. Call your siblings. Call your children. Call your spouses. Get the parish on board, your spouse. No spouses. If you have spouses, we need to talk. You can call me up. If you have spouses, that will be an interesting conversation. RelevantRadio.com, all right? RelevantRadio.com. You'll see it there. Just sign up for it, okay? Or your mobile app. And please tell others. Share it with all of your social media because you will be evangelizing by putting this in the hands of others. I don't know whether there will ever be another print run on this. There could be. Could be years from now. But be some of the few who get this book. Like I said, I don't know whether we'll run this again. So it's yours if you go now, relevantradio.com, relevantradio.com. You know, St. Faustina was given the chapel to Divine Mercy that we're about to pray, and the Lord told her specifically, pray this for the sick and for the dying, right? This is a prayer for those souls. Because, look, life goes on, and Satan, he tries to rob you of your eternity all throughout your life, but in that final hour, he is super aggressive. He wants you. And when we die, those who've had near-death experience, they often talk about what happens at the moment of death. They say the spirit rises from their body. And it's not as if, though, anything changes. It's like they say almost like the signal on a radio changes. How did they say that? The transmission still continues, but we're just at a different frequency. They have full awareness. In fact, hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of accounts of those whose life signals halted before they were resuscitated, right? Those who died, who said they peered the other side, indicate that they're not only aware, but they're more aware than ever. They're more alive than ever. In dying, you truly become alive. You enter your true state. You enter eternal life. You awaken. And Scripture tells us this, right? And so do near-death experiences. Like, this is not just a bunch of recent phenomena. Pope Gregory the Great, let me redefine that, in the 6th century had a near-death experience. And there's this consistent theme that runs for those who have seen it. Suddenly they see vastly more than their physical eyes can see. And with the freedom of the wind, with the speed of thought, they leave behind the laws of Einstein, right? And they can move. They can hear what's going on hundreds of miles away with family. They can see what's happening in the OR. They are fully aware. It's just amazing. We don't know. We don't understand. But you and I will one day encounter this. But you know, speaking of Bishop Chaput's book, speaking of preparing for this moment, as St. Faustina says, because Satan really, he wants our soul in that hour. I met a priest one time, and his story is well worth knowing. His name was Father Shire, Stephen Shire. I remember interviewing, I did a television interview with him once, and he was from Kansas, and he had to travel to Wichita, or maybe he wasn't. I knew he was in Wichita when this accident happened. He was in Wichita, I think on Highway 96, and he said he was on a special part of the highway that had no shoulders, right? Very hilly, and he went through these Flint Hills, and you know, it was traversed by trucks and semis. It was kind of a dangerous drive, he says. And he remembered returning late in the afternoon, and he said that's the last thing he remembered because he had an accident. He was involved in a head-on collision with a truck, right? There were three people in the vehicle, and nobody was killed in that accident, but here's what happened. As a result of the collision, he was thrown from the vehicle, right? Landed on the ground outside his car, and he suffered a major head concussion. At the time, the scalp on the right side of his head was completely torn off its skull. And he broke his neck. And behind him, on the highway was a Mennonite nurse. And he says she stopped, she came, and she attended to him until the ambulance came. They picked him up. And it was because of her expertise, it was discovered that he had suffered this broken neck. And she informed the drivers that they had to treat him accordingly. And he had the head trauma and everything else. But apparently he learned he suffered a C2 break of the vertebrae on the neck, which is the hangman's break. And because of that break in the neck, you know, when a person, that's how they kill you when they hang you. He was taken to a local hospital, and they had to lift him via helicopter to some other hospital. And during that process, he died. And during that death experience, he said he found himself before the throne of God. He found himself, he says, in a very dark place. First, he says, I was afraid to move because if I moved in any direction, I felt like I would fall for all eternity. And then I heard, he says, you know, and it was weird because for an instant, I don't know how long I was gone. I was outside of time. He says, then I had this life review. And I saw my entire life on earth, entire life. I didn't see anybody. I just saw this. And as I saw what I did, my own actions accused me of my sins, of my commissions, of my omissions, of those things I did not confess, of those things that were not repented of those things that were not forgiven. And the Lord said, Stephen, you have been a priest for yourself and not for me. And he says, all I could say is, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. When he says, when you're in the presence of divine truth, you can't do anything but speak truth. He says, I knew it was the Lord. I didn't see him, but I heard his voice. And he says, at the end of all of this life review, he says, Stephen, you have chosen your sentence, and that is hell. And Father Shire said, yes, Lord. He knew. It was logical. It wasn't a shock to his system. He knew that that's where he belonged. And what felt like an eternity, right? There was deafening silence. He heard a woman's voice. And the woman's voice said, Son, would you spare his life and his immortal soul? And the voice said back to him, this masculine voice said, Mother, he has been a priest for 12 years, not for himself, not for me. Let him reap the punishment he deserves. And she replied back, she said, but son, if we give him special graces, if we give him the strength, then see if he bears fruit. If not, your will be done. And again, there was a pause. To Father Shire, it felt like it was an eternity. But he heard the Lord say, Mother, he is yours. And with that, boom, he says, suddenly he was being resuscitated. He's back on the table. He's coming out of whatever situation he was in. And he was told he would be in traction, perhaps never walk again. And in the days ahead, he had this, and I only have a minute left, so I won't give you all the details. I'll give you the thumbnail here. He ended up being in bed and totally recommitting his life to God. He made a miraculous recovery to the amazement of doctors. He got out of there in much faster time than he ever committed. And he began to take this message of what happened to him and tell others. Tell others that the first reason for this experience is that hell does exist and there is consequence for sin. There is. It does exist. That's why these demons tried to rob so many souls in their final hour, and Faustina, through the chaplet, would ward them off. And he says, secondly, it's important that priests are also aware of this, because they are liable to hell also. In this age, a lot of people tend to dismiss the fact God is all just. You know, I tend to talk a lot about mercy. But God is also a God of justice. He told St. Faustina, before I come as a just judge, I first come as a merciful Savior. But woe to those who do not recognize this time of my visitation. We do not know when Christ is coming for us. It could be today. It could be in the next hour. It could be in the next week, the next year. But we will encounter not just God's mercy. I pray to God that's what I encounter. But we will also encounter his justice. And so often we poo-poo that. God understands. No, it's love, right? It's just love. And we excuse our actions, right? We justify our actions. Father Shire went on to really preach the message of confession, saying that this is the sacrament Jesus instituted first, you know, with his first appearance to his apostles. after he rose from the dead. And this is a sacrament of mercy. The Lord told St. Faustina that, look, you're not meeting a priest there. You're meeting Jesus Christ himself. And this is a sacrament that you should embrace this Lent. If you've not been to confession yet, what are you doing? Get to confession. Make a good and honest one. You're going to be glad you did. The Feast of Mercy is coming up on the last Sunday of Easter. You know, the last Sunday after Easter. The first Sunday after Easter, I should say. It's the octave of Easter. The eighth day of that octave. Get to confession. All right. Don't wait for then. Get to confession. Life does exist, right? Here on this side of the veil, but it certainly exists on the other. And where do you want to spend your eternity? That's something maybe this Lent to contemplate.